Today, I am with one of my favorite researchers in the field of positive psychology, and that's Sonia Lubomirsky, whom I've been privileged to meet at the University of Pennsylvania. Sonia is the professor of psychology at UC Riverside. She has a book coming out in January of 2008 from Penguin Press on how to become happier. And there's so much to say about Sonia that I'm going to refer you to her website and her biography, which is also here on the page. So, Sonia, welcome.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining me. We're going to keep this to a short time format because people want to get, you know, a dose of positive psychology quickly. So I'm going to ask you to jump right into something that my clients love to use, and then I want to open it up to other things around this intervention front. My clients love best possible self as a positive intervention. Could you tell me a little bit about why you think that works, why it builds hope, and then maybe some other positive interventions might even be more research validated?
Sure, sure. Well, we've used the best possible self intervention now twice. The last study we did, we had people, I think it was about an 8-week intervention where we had our participants write about, you know, the best possible future, and we chose them to do it in 10 years. So they talked about, they wrote in a journal for about 15 minutes once a week, kind of imagine yourself in 10 years and everything, you know, has come together, everything has, your dreams have been realized. And every week, I should say, we had people vary the domain in which they sort of thought about. So one week it was their romantic life, another week it was their health, another week it was the career. And we did that because we find in our work that variety is very important. You know, if you sort of do the same thing every week, you're going to, you know, it's going to get monotonous, it's going to feel more like a chore. And that works very nicely. I think it really works because not only does it kind of force you to become optimistic, it kind of makes you practice your optimistic muscles, but it also it sort of helps you understand kind of what are your goals. I had people tell me, you know, I just didn't even realize kind of what I really wanted in life. And also it might help you understand that some of your goals really are attainable, that they're things you can work for. And so it helps people sort of think about how to work towards their goals. So that's been very successful.
And is this like some of the other positive interventions where you need to keep doing it, even if you vary up the kinds of things you write about in order to get the biggest results?
You need to keep doing it, is that what you said?
Yes. Is it one of those kinds of exercises where if you do it once, you get a huge, you know, jolt, or do you have to keep doing it, like you said, in varied ways, like 1 week romantic, 1 week professional?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do believe that in almost all kind of happiness strategies that the people use, they need to put effort and kind of commitment, dedication into it and keep doing it. Now, the one caveat is that ideally those kind of strategies, whether it's optimism or gratitude or kindness or savoring, they ideally should become habits over time. And so once they become more habitual, then you don't have to kind of consciously and effortfully do it anymore. You know, when you think about people who are just naturally happy, who have born, you know, with a high happiness set point, they don't have to sort of tell themselves, oh, I have to, you know, be optimistic today. They just do it because it's a habit. And that's sort of the ultimate goal, is that these strategies turn into habits.
Okay, so the whole idea is that as you keep doing them, it's like becoming, you know, aware of brushing your teeth. It's something that you just do naturally because it has positive dividends and you feel the dividends.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Okay, so tell me about some of the other ones you said that are even more powerful in terms of being positive interventions.
Sure. We've done quite a few interventions. Probably the most powerful that we've done is an acts of kindness intervention. Now, sort of being kind to others can make people happy for many, many reasons. It's almost too obvious to talk about, but, you know, it makes you feel good about yourself. It wins you friends. It wins you appreciation and gratitude. It sort of gives you kind of a more, a more charitable perspective of other people in the world. And so we asked people, you know, do 5 kind of extra acts of kindness this week, you know, every week, things that you don't normally do, right? Because we all do acts of kindness on a regular basis. We may not even notice it. And this is very powerful because it's partly because it's really a behavioral intervention. You're actually sort of doing things. People, you know, they say they, you know, do extra chores around the house, they visit a nursing home, they donate money to charity, they help a friend with babysitting or with homework, you know, they do lots and lots of things, and that's very powerful. So that's one, and then, go ahead.
No, well, I was just going to say, if you do an act of kindness, does it matter whether other people know you did that act of kindness or not?
It does not. I mean, you become happier no matter what. Although I should say that if people notice it, you also get the social benefits, right? The sort of the appreciation, and you know, people might reciprocate later. So I actually haven't tested this yet, but I think that when people notice it or are aware of it, then the benefits are somewhat greater.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. So another.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry?
The other ones you were going to talk about, I'm interrupting.
Yeah. So we also have done interventions where we get people to express gratitude. And in one study, we just had people kind of count their blessings, which means, you know, just every week you write down what you're grateful for. We've done other studies where we have people actually write letters of gratitude, but not send them or not share them necessarily. And it also is quite powerful. I should add to that, I myself have tried the gratitude strategy, and it just doesn't work for me at all. You know, I just feel like it's too hokey. You know, I feel it's too artificial. And so just to add a note, I think it's very, very important to choose something that really fits your personality, your resources, your needs, your goals, your values. And so if you do something that doesn't quite fit you, then it's not going to be effective. And so that's also something that I write about. And in my book, I have a chapter on fit. And I actually came up with a sort of a test or a diagnostic where people can try to figure out what strategies they should use.
So can you give us like a quick and dirty, you know, crib sheet here on, let's say you do the signature strengths on the Authentic Happiness website. Are there some strengths that would come up in the top five that might be more correlated with doing a gratitude visit versus, say, counting your blessings?
That may be true. One way to sort of figure out what the highest fit is to sort of see what your strengths are. And so if you have a strength, if gratitude is a strength, then that's something you can work on. Another way is to do it the opposite and sort of consider what your weaknesses are and try to kind of address those, right? So if gratitude is a weakness, then you should try to do it. But I actually assess fit in a much more straightforward way. Basically, I ask people to consider, you know, different strategies like kindness or savoring or gratitude, and, you know, consider it and think about, like, how would you feel if you had to do this, you know, every week for a long time? Would it feel natural to you? Would you enjoy it? Would you find this valuable? And if the answer is yes to all those questions, then it probably is a high-fitting strategy for you. I do think it's very important because I think people might read books or look at websites and they'll learn about some sort of happiness exercise and they just feel like, God, this is not for me, you know. And just because you feel that way doesn't mean that there's not some other strategy that you could find that is for you.
Are there some you haven't mentioned that are obvious, like exercise, that really do serve as positive interventions on a regular basis that you see either personally or professionally?
Yes. Well, in my book, I have actually different chapters on the different strategies, and exercise is one of them. So physical activity is a very powerful kind of exercise strategy. I don't want to use the word exercise strategy to become happier. Again, it's not for everyone. Mm-hmm. I also talk about things like meditation. I talk about religion and spirituality, right? So if this is up your alley, becoming more involved in, you know, your church, temple, mosque, sort of becoming more spiritual, sort of practicing that, practicing prayer can be very powerful for some people. Another one is developing strategies for coping, right? Because all of us have, you know, stressful and traumatic events happen to us, you know, once in a while at least. And so learning how to cope well with, you know, negative things is an important strategy as well. Another one I talk about is nurturing relationships, right? Because it turns out that happier people have more successful and sort of stronger intimate relationships, friendships, family relationships. And so kind of thinking about those, trying to, you know, make them better, cultivating relationships is an important strategy. And there are many others. I mean, I think the news is, it's not sort of news to anyone, sort of how to become happier. I mean, you know, I don't think anyone's going to be surprised to learn, oh, gee, you know, making your relationships better is going to make me happier. I think what's hard is, or what's important to learn is sort of how to implement those things. And so I talk about the importance of putting effort into sort of those strategies, the importance of fit, the importance of having social support, people who kind of support your endeavor. So it's sort of really how and why do they work is my interest in my research.
Right. My guess is, I mean, I'm a coach by trade. I find that having a coach is another great way to keep people accountable and moving forward, someone who's even trained in understanding these. So I agree. I think it's how do you keep doing them, and coaching has turned out to be a wonderful way to do that. You mentioned something that my clients love to learn more about, and that's your work on rumination and dysphoria. And I love the 8-minute distraction technique. Can you tell me a little bit more about how and why it works to distract yourself?
Sure. Well, avoiding rumination or overthinking is a very important strategy or exercise in sort of trying to become happier. If you're a chronic ruminator, trying to address that is really key to sort of your success. And so, so the strategies that you can use to kind of avoid or sort of inhibit, prevent overthinking are really quite simple, or they sound simple, like distraction. It almost sounds too easy, like too much of a quick fix, and yet we do studies where we have people distract just for 8 minutes. And by distracting, I just mean think about something else. In our study, we just have people think about images like the Statue of Liberty, a fan whirring in the heat. So just distract yourself, and it doesn't really matter. I mean, what I tell people is just find something compelling that's distracting. Because some people, because talking to other people can be distracting, but not always, because sometimes other people ruminate along with you.
Right.
You know what I mean? Right.
Right.
I used to go running, as a form of distraction. And then I found that when I was running, I would ruminate,
right.
And then that didn't work. So it's find something sort of compelling and engaging. And another technique is people just will yell, stop, when you find themselves ruminating. And that's basically also a distraction technique as well.
Do you think that one of the better ways to snap this, rumination might be getting involved with a social group or an activity that causes you to savor happy memories, such as scrapbooking?
Yeah, sure. Yes, exactly. I mean, that just falls into that category, finding something that's sort of engaging and compelling. Social activities are usually very engaging and compelling and distracting. And if they're positive sort of emotions involved, that's all the better, because as we know from Bob Fredrickson's work, positive emotions can kind of help undo the effects of negative emotions, and overthinking and rumination. Basically what it's doing is it's enhancing or making worse sort of all your negative emotions. So if you're feeling a little bit anxious, or if you're feeling a little bit sad, ruminating just makes you feel even more anxious or even more sad, so you want to kind of try to undo those emotions.
And I think when I was reading your research, one of the things that popped out at me is your problem solving just isn't all that fantastic when you allow yourself to kind of get stuck, and that the people, the coders who were listening to the ruminators who actually spoke out loud about their thinking, were basically sitting there going, well, their life is no worse than mine.
Yeah, exactly. So we find that when you ruminate, you feel kind of overwhelmed. You're pessimistic about everything. You feel kind of a loss of control. You're not very good at solving problems. I mean, because when you're ruminating, everything seems so kind of horrible that you just sort of aren't very. You don't end up using adaptive strategies to try to address your problems. So that's why it's so important to distract and to kind of stop yourself from ruminating. Now, I should say there are times that you need to kind of think about your problems, right? So I'm not saying you should just sort of never think about your problems, but rumination is different from problem solving, right? Because rumination is sort of a passive kind of repetitive process where you're just sort of not going anywhere. You're kind of going from A to B to A to B to A to B, right? Problem solving is actually going from A to B to C to D. And you want to do that when you're feeling more neutral or more positive, not when you're feeling depressed or anxious.
Okay, so when you're depressed and anxious, the best strategy is some form of distraction to induce a more optimistic frame of mind, at which point you can begin to problem solve, possibly with somebody else, but
exactly.
Even alone. Okay.
Exactly.
Finally, the other piece of research that I use a lot with clients is that really kind of seminal work you did where you reviewed all the studies on well-being, and you really concluded that success comes from happiness, not the other way around. Tell me a little bit more about that.
I mean, basically, up to now, almost all researchers have asked the question, what makes people happy, right? Does money make people happy? Do relationships make people happy? And that's all. Those are very important questions. And so we decided to sort of turn that question on its head and ask about whether maybe being happy actually sort of leads you to be more likely to kind of attain success, right? So we review many, many studies, I think about 220-something studies that show, that provide evidence that actually once you are happy, you're more likely to find a marriage partner. Mm. Once you are happy, you're more likely to kind of find jobs that are more meaningful and are more high earning. Once you are happy, you're more likely to have a sort of a stronger immune system and better health and more creativity and lots of other things. And it really, sometimes people say, oh, wait, that's so unfair. So those happy people, they're not only feeling good, but they also get all these benefits. But the way I interpret it is that it's sort of one more really excellent reason to try to become happier, because when you become happier, not only are you making yourself feel better, but you're improving yourself in many other ways, and you're also really affecting your relationships, your families, and your, even the community at large.
Right, and so as a goal-setting coach, one of the things I think you would probably say to my clients is work on your well-being, because if you work on your well-being, you're far more likely to be a creative problem solver, to have social support, and then that will help you accomplish your goals.
Exactly, and then it becomes a vicious cycle, or I guess I should say an upward spiral, right? So you're becoming happier, and then that makes you more successful in reaching your goals, that makes you even more happier, and so on in an upward spiral.
That is terrific. Well, thank you so much. We've run out of time, and I don't want to eat up your time, but I can't wait to read your book. It'll be out in January of 2008, Title to Be Determined, from Penguin Press. Thank you so much, Sonia.
Thank you so much, Darlene.
I'm going to stop the recording right now and say a private goodbye to you.